Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Boothman, and with me is David Leddy, writer and director of Sub Rosa, which starts out as a late-night tour of a Masonic lodge, but quickly develops into something even spookier and more disturbing. David, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello.
Congratulations, first of all, on picking up another Herald Angel for Sub Rosa.
Thank you.
Your first one was for White Tea last year.
It was indeed.
Yes, and this year you've got the Little Devil.
Well, I didn't get that specifically. The venue that that we're performing in was given the Little Devil Award for presenting the work, because it's, you know, as everyone knows, the Fringe, you know, you have to share your venue with about 2 million other people, and you have a 20-second get-in and all of that. And Sub Rosa is an incredibly complicated show, and it runs like a military operation, and it requires use of the whole building. And most Fringe venues would not countenance something like that, particularly for, that has an audience of 25 people at a time, seven times a night and running late into the night. But Tim Hawkins, who is running Remarkable Arts at Hill Street Theatre, is fantastic. And we went and described the whole thing to him, and he went, yeah, okay, yeah. And pretty much every question we've asked him since then, he said, yeah, okay. Which has been a thrill and a shock.
Fantastic. So the play Sub Rosa premiered at the Citizens Theatre in Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
And has now transferred to this lodge, the Hill Street Theatre, for the Fringe. So did you always have this lodge in mind when you were writing and developing the show, or did you kind of stumble on it afterwards and go, wow, this would be perfect for Sub Rosa?
It was the latter. It was written for backstage in the theatre, and in the future I will probably only present it in theatres. But obviously, within the context of Edinburgh Fringe, theatres are very hard to come by. And so we started looking at other buildings that had some kind of thematic fit, and the Masonic Lodge was, you know, an obvious one for a play about secrecy. You know, Sub Rosa is the legal term for secrecy, and so it kind of, you know, moved from there. But in transferring it from one site to the other, it hasn't really needed all that much rewriting. You know, on a conceptual level, you're talking about a Masonic lodge that's being used as a theatre, and so that sort of fits very well to the piece, because the piece is talking about a fictionalised theatre. The original version wasn't set in the Citizens Theatre. It wasn't site-specific in the sense that it was about that building. It was about theatre and theatres in general, and a fictional theatre called the Winter Palace. And so the narrative still, you know, is set in the Winter Palace, but there's these Masonic overtones that go with it that have been sort of woven within the text. And the piece now begins with a different introductory safety lecture from your tour guide, which originally talked about the citizens and now talks about all of the theatres in the area. And so it becomes situated not just in the building that you're in, but the whole city that you're in. And I think probably in the future, when we tour it internationally, what I would like to do is develop a version where that introductory lecture isn't talking about so much the just the, you know, the building or the city that you're in, but about that genre of work around the world. So it's saying, you know, it's, you know, talking to you about, you know, particular theatres that were built in New York, or the Café Concert in Paris, or, you know, those kind of things. So the sense of it happening in all of those types of venues at the same time, and that you're sort of in multiple sites at the same time psychically. That's how I envisage it. Whether or not I can pull that off is entirely another matter.
So tell us a little bit about this specific site that it's in at the Fringe, because I understand getting permission to perform there was a bit of an ordeal, or
well,
to perform
no,
in certain of the rooms.
We tell people it was an ordeal as part of the show, but it's a lie.
Oh.
It was much easier than you would imagine. Because the building, it's a working Masonic lodge, and it has the oldest Masonic minutes in the world from July 1599, and they have a museum room where they keep all of their Masonic artefacts. And the building has been used for many years as a Fringe venue, but just in two rooms. And so we're the first people to have been allowed to use the whole building. And the Masons were reluctant to let us use the museum room, but Tim Hawkins, that I was just talking about, in his marvellous way, went, oh, well, I'll talk the Masons around. And he came back at the next meeting and said, yeah, I talked them around, it's fine. I just offered them a bit more money, it's all okay. So as part of the show, we, you know, the tour guide kind of plays up the idea that we had these tortuous negotiations with the Masons and the City Council and the Fire Department, and actually it went remarkably smoothly, particularly licensing. The licensing department of Edinburgh Council are really, really brilliant in their kind of understanding of how fringe venues need to work. And that's one of the reasons why Edinburgh Fringe has been able to flourish, is because in other cities, the licensing would never allow all of these pop-up places to work in that way. And in Edinburgh, they're very accommodating. And, you know, and they're very thorough, and they want, you know, everything to be safe, but they... where in a lot of other cities they would say no automatically, Edinburgh really tried to make it work for everyone.
Okay, so were you interested in the Masons before you started doing this project, or did the site lead you to kind of research into that to adapt the
Yeah,
play?
It was the latter. It was, you know, when we couldn't find a theatre, I started asking around everyone that I could think of what, you know, what buildings do they think would work. And the two Masonic lodges were our first choice because of the thematic link, and then we went and looked, and you know, and it's a great building, and so it, you know, it works very well. It's a very difficult building to present Sub Rosa in because the first audience come in and went into one room with one actor, and then as they move to the second room, the next audience come in behind them, and this happens so every 20 minutes. So there's one point where there are five audiences in five different parts of the building. And the show is happening, you know, in, you know, five different locations at the same time. So it has to be run like a military operation, and there are computers in all of the spaces, and there are infrared cameras in some spaces, so we know what's going on. All of the tour guides have in-ear earpieces like bouncers, and can all talk to the stage management. And so doing all of that becomes very, very challenging, and that's part of what you kind of have to look at when you're looking at those buildings. But particularly the sound bleed between different rooms is an enormous problem, because when you're moving 175 people around a small building, but trying to make them all feel like they're alone in the building becomes very difficult. So we put a lot of work into checking sound levels, WD-40ing internal hinges on doors, putting neutral density gel on emergency lighting. You know, it's all really, really boring and really uncreative, but very, very necessary. And in, you know, training the tour guides to walk at a particular speed that means that the audience's footfalls are lighter, particularly as they leave at the end of the piece, you can hear them all walking on a seating bank, which is a temporary seating bank, and is very, very, very creaky, and therefore is you can hear it in the fourth room, which is a particularly quiet, particularly intense piece of performance, and you don't really want to hear 25 people, you know, galumphing out in the room next door. So that it requires a lot of careful management, which was difficult in the Citizens, which is a huge, you know, 140-year-old music hall, but is particularly different in a tiny building like this, and where we don't really have the money for lots of soundproofing or the time to put it up, you know, because it's a working fringe venue. So we get the building an hour before we open, which in fringe terms is quite a long time, right? But, you know, in terms of creating a sort of, trying to create some sort of, you know, immersive installation that people walk through is very challenging. And certainly in the original version, we had a lot more time to do that.
I have to say, I actually had no idea there were other people in the building. Well, I saw it last night, and I'd assumed that the kind of the little voices and creaks and noises I could hear were sound effects.
Oh, really? So. Yeah, I mean, the sound designer has done very well in kind of creating sound effects which kind of fit that sense. And I think generally the creaking and the shuffling does sound like stuff that's been designed, because a lot of the sound effects are, you know, real, you know, sounds like dripping taps and shuffling and rain outside. Yeah, that's probably my favourite one in this building is... that in the fourth room there's a very, very realistic sound effect of rain on the window, and people are often shocked when they come out of at the end and realise that it hasn't been raining at all. But my favourite sound effect of all is that when you first enter the building, coming out from under the staircase is this a low, rich, rumbling sound, which is actually the sound of a cheetah purring, which almost sounds like a machine. It's such a bassy sound, and it's recorded very, very close from the cheetah's nose, and it's a remarkable sound, and I love it, and it gives me a chill every time I hear it.
So being given access to all these kind of the secret rooms that the Masons don't normally let people in, sort of spending time in these rooms, have you decoded any Masonic secrets?
No, or? I haven't tried. I mean, the thing that's funny, of course, is that, you know, the Masons have this reputation for being incredibly secretive and scary, and they're actually kind of banal. You know, they're essentially just, you know, a gentleman's club, and they're nowhere near as sort of frightening as one would, as some people imagine them to be, or as far as I can tell. I don't know. We don't get to meet any of them. The Tim Hawkins, the who runs the venue, deals with them directly. So I've never met any of them.
So you've no idea whether any of them have attended the show?
No, I haven't. But what I have seen is that there have been some. I get Google alerts of, you know, so I can find out what people are saying around the work, and there have been posts on Masonic chat rooms. With where they just sent links to reviews about the show, or just articles and interviews with me and stuff, and people have, you know, posted responses saying, "Are you going to go and see the show, brother?" And the person responded, "No, I live miles away from Edinburgh." You know, so there's this sense of some Masons having noticed it, okay. But that's kind of all. It would be interesting to see what they thought.
Yes, well, because the reason I ask is that the brethren don't exactly come out of the show smelling of roses. No.
But then, to be fair, nobody does. No. Nobody gets off lightly. You know, it's a very bleak piece of work.
It is. It's very distressing subject matter.
Yes.
In fact, last night...
Where does that come from? I'm quite chipper in real life.
Yes, last night when I saw the show, one member of the audience actually... between two of the rooms, I think it was after the Miss Thorne room, had to stop on the stairs and kind of bend double and breathe deep, I think, to stop herself throwing up, which was, you know, it's
very common.
It's an incredibly powerful
somebody was
piece of work.
The night before.
Really?
Yeah.
And
so just as a very important promoter was going into the show, there were two ambulances outside the venue with a teenager being loaded into it. It was really quite a difficult experience for everybody.
And I think it's interesting because the show is... None of the distressing material in the show is reenacted. It's all simply recounted. Mm-hmm. So was that something that you were... Was that a response you were setting out to get to kind of look into the power of words alone?
Absolutely. I'm very interested in the power of that imagination, and for the same reason you never meet the major characters. Partly that's pragmatic, that the heroine of the story is a 12-year-old girl who is, described as being very, very physically slight, and I would never be able to find an actor who physically looked young enough and had the skill as an actor to pull off that role. But the same thing with the her protagonist, the Hunter, the theatre manager in the piece, is set up as this sort of almost supernatural, villainous character who has this mesmerizing power over people, and that's a role that's much more convincing in people's imagination than it is with an actor reenacting it. And so that was absolutely central to it, that I wanted everything to be described and not shown. But also in terms of the sort of high, gruesome impact of it, it's a piece of Gothic, and I thought if we're going to do it, then let's fucking do it. Let's not kind of mess around, and if we're going to be gruesome, then let's really be gruesome, because then for me you start looking into interesting conceptual and ethical questions about what that means. Certainly what I want is a sense of a piece that where you feel drawn into it, and then you're kind of made to feel kind of dirty for having been drawn into that voyeurism. And I particularly like in the last scene that Ida McCracken that says that she wonders why she did things and why she didn't do them, and at one point she says, "And so I do the same thing as you, I do nothing." For me that's a very important part of the piece, the sense that actually we're all complicit in this world and this this desire to see these brutal things reenacted, which I find fascinating, the psychology of that kind of work.
So it is the whole story from your own imagination, or is any of it based in fact?
I made it all up. I did actually have a very funny conversation with someone at a Christmas party where they suddenly said, "Oh my God, are you David Leddy?" and I wondered, I don't know if they worked for the bank or something. No, I have a good relationship with my bank. But and she said, oh my god, I saw Sub Rosa, and oh my god, what's going on in your mind? What happened to you as a child? And you know, she was really, really going for it. And I said, you know, I made it all up, right? And she said, no, but you must have had a very disturbed childhood. And I said, no, actually, my parents are really, really very sweet people. I had a very happy childhood. I made it up. And she would not take it. And her friend tried to be diplomatic, and her friend was saying, well, you know, I used to know a writer who wrote a book about mental illness, and it was very successful. He was talking about Janice Galloway and the book The Trick is to Keep Breathing, which is a fantastic book. And he said that Janice was quite, you know, annoyed that for years later she would get, you know, invitations to speak about her mental illness. And, you know, and she was saying, I made it up. That was, you know, that wasn't my life. That was my skill. And so her friend was saying that, and she said, no, absolutely not. You haven't seen this play. It's just so distressing. And I said, you know, I you have to believe I'm not a Victorian chorus girl. You know, I made it up. And then later in the conversation, I talked about my partner, and she said, wait, is your partner a man or a woman? And I said, he's a man. And she went, right, that explains it. And by this point, it was starting to annoy me. And I said, okay, explains what? And she said, that explains, you were angry because you weren't allowed to fuck men. That's why you've made this. Like, okay, I think I got over that anger about 20 years ago when I started doing that. So that doesn't really make sense. And I left, and I spoke to Ollie Emmanuel, who's another writer. And he said, oh, you should have, when she asked you where you get your ideas from, you should have given Agatha Christie's answer, that when people asked her where she got her ideas from, she would say, Harrods, darling. That's been my response ever since.
Do you think it's a Hollywood thing, that people are starting to, people think that every character quirk of real people and of characters in literature and theatre and film all have to trace back to the childhood? And
no, I don't think it's a Hollywood thing. I think it's a very natural psychological impulse to think, you know, that must have come from somewhere. I'm interested that there's psychological studies that have found that we basically believe everything that we're told immediately, and that it's later another thought process rationalizes it and decides whether or not to stop believing it. But our instinct is to believe everything that we're told. And I think it's part of that instinct, is that, and particularly in a piece like this, which is very, you're very close to the actors, it's and the performances generally are, you know, very small and very, very convincing. And there's this sense that it's very counterintuitive to think that this is all false, that this has all been made up. And I think it's part of that. And also, I think sometimes it just comes from people's lack of knowledge, that if you're not someone who has made artistic works of some kind, then the process is much more opaque to you, and you don't really know how someone begins to do that, and they don't know where the ideas come from. And so I try to generally be very open and tolerant to those sort of clumsy questions that people might ask. Someone asked me the other day, the audience walk around in your piece, don't they? Where did you get the idea for that? Which I think is very, in a way, it's a really sweet question. I was like, well, I can walk. Please believe me, I'm really not the first person to do this. This is, you know, a very, 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 you know, well-trodden path.
So you've talked a little bit already about the future of the play. You want to tour it. Mm-hmm. What are the future plans for Sub Rosa?
They will present it again. There are various places that are interested. I probably would be reluctant to present it in a space that wasn't a theatre. Again, it's intended for backstage in a theatre. But surprisingly, when I first made it, I thought, this is brilliant. I'll be able to do it backstage in any old theatre. And actually, there aren't many old theatres that still look like that backstage. Most of them were renovated in the 70s or more recently, and they're actually very boring backstage. And it's only the main houses that have been left to, you know, to have that magic. So we'll have to see how many people can pull that off. And it's a strange time to be making a piece like this economically, because it's not enormously expensive piece, but it's pretty expensive, and it plays to fairly small audiences. And so, you know, an economic and political climate where there's not much money knocking about, it's a challenging thing to pull off. But there seems to be a huge amount of interest in it, so that's lovely. I feel very, very pleased and relieved.
Fairly small audiences, but several times a night, which I suppose offsets it to some extent.
In this venue, it comes out at 175 people a night, which is not enormous, but is not, you know,
for
that
the fringe,
tiny
it's
for
of,
this kind of work.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in terms of its future life, it works well as a loss leader, an opening loss leader for festivals. That, you know, it's a show that you open your festival with. It gets lots of buzz. Everyone talks about how they couldn't get in. You were really lucky. You managed to get a ticket, and you make sure that all of the audience who do come, you know, get given a copy of the festival brochure before they leave, and it, you know, and so it kind of gets the festival going with a bang. And in that sense, the money that you don't make in your large ticket sales comes back later in people's interest in the other shows in the festival.
Okay, and what about for you? What's the future for you? What's next on the table?
The next thing on the table is I made a piece last year called I made it about 3 years ago, called Susurrus, where the audience follow a map around a botanic garden and they listen to the piece on headphones as they stop in 8 different stations. And that's continuing to travel all around the world. And so last year we did it in Cork and in Oxford and in Edinburgh and in Milan. And now this year we've just done it in New Haven and in London. And then as soon as the Fringe closes with Sub Rosa, I go on to Ann Arbor in Michigan to present it there. And then I go on a research trip to Brazil, Chile and Argentina to meet theatre companies who will make translations and re-recordings of it. And then I come home for a few weeks and then I go back to the States again to present it in Columbus, Ohio and the Kennedy Center in Washington. So I'm away from home a bit too much, really. My cat doesn't recognize me anymore.
Right, well, best of luck with the future of Sub Rosa. Best of luck
Thank
with Susurrus. David Leddy, thanks for talking to Theatre Voice.
My pleasure.